welcome to Something's Off with Andrew Heaton. I'm your host, Ted Baxter. And today we're going to be talking about sex, or rather, the dearth of sex presently accompanying the United States people. Most of the data that's out there right now, most of the empirical research indicates that Americans are actually having less sex now than we have been historically, which might come to a surprise to you if you're watching any amount of television or movies, which tend to portray us as everyone having sex but you. But in fact, that is not the case. There are statistical declines in the amount of sex. People are waiting later to start having sex, and they tend to be having less sex in their 20s and 30s. And I'm going to talk to Billy Binion of Reason about why that is and what the underlying structural problems are. Afterwards, we're going to do a little bit of mea culpa. I'm going to give you an update on the unrelated Virginia controversy that's been happening with the governor there that did blackface a few years ago. And I'm going to air out a couple of the skeletons in my closet in hopes of just getting ahead of some stuff. So no big deal. Don't worry about it. You don't even need to listen to it, to be honest with you. I'm just going to go ahead and put it out there. But first, a word from our sponsor. Something's Off with Andrew Heaton is brought to you by Snuffy's off Route 44. Snuffy's is a fine American diner which prides itself in great food and good times. With 1/8 of a Michelin star, you can count on Snuffy's for the finest pistachio burger this side of the Missouri River, and the best deep-fried sauerkraut on either. But Snuffy's is known first and foremost for its talented waitstaff, who take your order and serve it to you on horseback. Valentine's Day is coming up, and so to celebrate, Snuffy's invites you to take your significant other to an evening which is equal parts romantic and equestrian. This week, Snuffy's has hired a 4-piece string quartet to play beautiful music on horseback. Yes, just imagine the amorous passions unleashed in your heart and loins when you hear 3 men in tuxedos playing string instruments and also a lady named Maud in a snazzy cocktail dress working that cello, each seated on their own mount playing an instrumental version of Come On, Eileen. Between those mounted musicians and the candlelit ambiance, you can be sure your entree of Rocky Mountain oysters will be the most erotic bucket of fried calf testicles you've ever consumed. And when that 4-piece band strikes up Freebird, you can look across the glistening linoleum tabletop and watch your date's eyes dilate. And they'll smile and look at you and say, "I am so experiencing love right now. Take me home and breed with me." Then they'll break into uncontrollable paroxysms of French, just as regular adults do when they're in love. If you're planning to spend Valentine's Day at Snuffy's, be sure to make a reservation before things fill up. Call 844-768-3397. That's 844-SNUFFY'S. And if you leave a voicemail detailing how much you enjoyed your last meal there, you might win a free meal in the future, and I might play it on the show. Snuffy's off Route 44, because everything tastes better from a horse. My guest today is Billy Binion. He is a rising star at Reason, and maybe, just maybe, he'll fix the laggardly sexuality of the United States by the conclusion of this interview. Billy, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what I wanted to talk to Billy about is I've seen a number of headlines over the last couple of years that say we are in a sex recession, which I was initially thrilled at, because even though there's a lot of people worried about it, my ideal sexuality rate for the United States is about 20% less than whatever amount of sex I'm having. That's the ideal for society. It should be 20% less than Heaton. But there are,
right.
Yeah, thank you. See, we're already on the same page. There are a lot of people that however, are kind of worried about this. So we'll dig into it in a minute. Before we jump in, I kind of want to give you some background on what people mean by this. If you hear the phrase sex recession, mostly it's pertaining to people that are maybe under 40, and there's a lot of research on teenagers and people in their early 20s. The long and the short of it in America is that teenagers are waiting later to have sex, and that kind of goes across the board. Just in general, the first encounter of sexuality is delayed, and the amount of sex is also declining. I will say not precipitously. It looks like it's, you know, somewhere between 10 to 20% less sex, depending on the survey you're reading. But that's going down, as is the fecundity of the United States, which is to say our birth rate is declining. You want 2.1 babies for every woman if you want to maintain the current birth rate. We're at about 1.7 right now. So were it not for immigration, the United States would actually be shrinking in population over time. I don't think it's like at a point of crisis or anything like that here, but it is interesting to watch it play out across the globe. So in other parts of the world, in Britain, they have a national survey of sexual attitudes and lifestyles, and it says that ages 16 to 44 are having more than six times, it's gone down from 6 times a month to 5 times a month. So that staid British sex has declined somewhat. Australians, this blew my mind, that's gone from 1.8 times a week to 1.4 times a week. I thought the Dutch were fantastic because the Dutch, and looking at them, for America, whenever our teen sexuality goes down, we kind of celebrate it and go, oh, good, less teenagers having sex, whereas the Dutch kind of get worried because they view it as like, oh, no, there's less orgasms. So they're kind of freaked out. And then Japan would be the one that actually is something of a difficult case because Japan right now, in 2005, the research is that a third of Japanese singles, 18 to 34, were still virgins. And by 2015, 43% of people 18 to 34 were still virgins. And aside from all of the morality of that, there is an actual economic impact to that because they do not have enough Japanese people to run their economy, pay for the entitlements, that kind of thing. And so they're actually quite worried about that. And so I'll kick it to you, Billy. Are we in a sex recession, and should we be worried about it?
You know, I think we definitely are in some kind of sex recession. I would say that out of all of the factors that, you know, could be attributed to it, I would say that the rise of online dating would certainly be, at least in my experience, something that makes dating a lot ironically harder than it does easier. Because I think that one thing I've always really identified with is the idea that when you have so many choices, everything just doesn't seem as good.
Yeah.
Kind of the reason why they always say that speed dating is quite unsuccessful.
I agree with all of you on that. So I'm 35. How old are you?
I am 27.
Perfect. Okay. So you and I are both still within the millennial range. However, I think your iGen were around iGen, whereas I'm an elder millennial. I'm a fifth-year senior in the millennial camp.
Got it.
And so I came into online dating in my mid to late 20s. But for you, that was always a thing, right?
I actually would kind of push back on that a little bit.
Yeah.
When I was in college, Tinder wasn't really a thing.
And okay.
You know, a lot of people obviously try to date in college, although I guess it's easier because it's just like a bunch of young people stuffed into like
you're in a blender full of like, you know, a bunch of 20 somethings with alcohol and pheromones. See, I don't
exactly.
I never found that online dating was going to be needed in college. It might be now. I don't know.
Apparently it is now, which might be part of the sex recession that people are talking
that
about.
That saddens me tremendously. When I was in college, online dating was not a thing. And in fact, it was regarded as a kind of admission of failure if you were online dating between 2003 and 2007 when I was there.
Was that like eHarmony, though?
Yes, I'll say I don't think there really were young dating sites. They were typically older, and they were kind of they were either you're getting married in your 40s or 50s, or they were sort of a carryover from old personal ads that you see in newspapers that had kind of like made the jump. And then prior to me in the 90s, way before this was on my radar, there were some fantastic dating services where you would get a VHS tape. And if listeners, if you have time to kill, look up 90s dating tapes because they're amazing.
I'm going to look it up.
But because we had the stigma of that from the 90s, we all kind of remembered, the online dating was not a normal part of romance, and it was not something that you did nor would talk about. And it didn't become normalized, I don't think, until around 2010. Because I remember when my friends first started doing it, and it was like now it's very much out in the open, and I mean, everybody does it. But in 2010, it was kind of a watershed period where people would do online dating and they'd get quizzed by their friends for, you know, an hour or two about what the experience was like, what was the person like, and that kind of thing. And so when were you in college, Billy?
I graduated in 2013, and I actually really do agree with you that even when I had first gotten out of college, I guess Tinder still wasn't a thing, but I think if you remember OkCupid, that was when that was, you know, the dawn of OkCupid. And I do remember that if you were using it around then, it was definitely kind of a stamp of desperation, or you weren't trying hard enough in other venues, I suppose. But I will say that I think that, you know, I was talking to someone older, maybe a family member, and, you know, she said something like, you know, why doesn't anyone just ask you out at the grocery store or something? And I was just like, I don't think people do that anymore.
Yeah.
I would be fine if someone asked me out at the grocery store, but, you know, I feel like that's kind of a dead art.
I agree with you. I think, in researching this, it seemed to me that there were any number of factors we can point to in terms of why there's less sex happening. I think the main factor is that it's not that hookup culture is resulting in more sex, which you would counterintuitively think. And that I think that is also very much overemphasized in culture right now in terms of the actual amount of people engaging in hookup culture.
I would agree with you.
For the record, I'm at the point in my life where I would love to either get married or be in hookup culture. Either one of those sounds greatly appealing to me. But I'm not. I'm in that middle zone of like, well, I guess I'll go on a date every couple of weeks and we'll see what will happen. I think most people are kind of in that range. When I talk to like folks in their 50s or 60s, they tend to have a very inflated understanding of my dating life that does not play out. You know, I'll talk to guys that are, you know, they've been married for quite some time. And they're like, oh, what I wouldn't give to be a young buck like you out dating a different filly every night. And I'm like, this is not my experience. This is not my life anymore. I don't know what your 20s or 30s were like.
I know you very well.
Yeah. So I think that that's overdone. But it is this kind of oddly counterintuitive thing, because you would think that hookup culture, and we have had a lot of sexual mores cease or decline. A lot of the old inhibitions we had culturally are gone. And you would think between that and the rise of dating apps that people would be having tremendous tidal waves of sex everywhere. But in fact, numerically and statistically, based on all available research, Americans are having less sex than they were in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And the millennials, of which you and I are cohorts, are having less sex than our immediate predecessors, Gen X. And I think the main reason for that is not that sex itself has fundamentally changed. I think it's just coupling up has declined considerably.
Oh, I would totally agree. And I think it kind of speaks to like the irony of all social media, which I would include in dating apps, but you know, of course, the new Instagram culture, Facebook culture, whatever, is that it connects us more and more, but everyone feels, I mean, there are all these studies that show that especially Generation Z, which is nicknamed, you know, the digital generation or whatever, that they feel lonelier than any other generation because you have all these 15-year-old high school girls who are trying to be Instagram models. And this is very isolating, even though they're projecting this image of, you know, having so many friends and, you know, loving life so much, when on the inside, I suppose it can feel quite empty.
All of that makes sense to me. I like Instagram because I kind of view it like I'm assembling my own coffee table book.
It
tends
it
to be a little bit happier,
honestly.
But I could see how that would, like, I was in part of the research that I did for this, I looked up new dating terms for 2019. Maybe we'll get to these, but I'm honestly more interested in the whole declining sexuality of the United States. One of the terms was Instagrandstanding, and it's a new term that you can share with your friends at home, where you curate your Instagram feed with one person in mind. And I read that and went, well, ladies, I hope you like waistcoats, because my Instagram feed is not anywhere near promoting myself as a viable guy. Most of my stuff looks like I'm auditioning for a bit part in a community theater production of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh my gosh.
As opposed to a lot of people.
You would get the starring role for sure.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So maybe I'm Instagrandstanding for the Dallas Community Association or Community Theater Association.
I don't do so much Instagrandstanding. I'm more of a grande-ing boy.
Yeah. What is grande-ing?
That's when after you have a breakup, I usually use it after one or two bad days, where you sing thank you next, you know, if you have a hit song that's taken the world by storm.
See, I don't like broadcasting that stuff publicly.
I don't broadcast it publicly. I just talk to my friends.
Oh, right. Okay.
Thank you next.
Yeah. I do that. I talk to, I have like a phone tree of people that I will immediately call to prep them. I just don't like putting it on Twitter and detailing my romantic life.
I am very private about that as well.
But to go back, I think you're right. I think coupling has declined, and that's for a variety of reasons that we could get into. Coupling as an institution is not quite as emphatic as it used to be. People are getting married later, and just if we're just going to crunch the numbers here on sex, you're more likely to be having sex regularly if you're in a relationship, because the guesswork's taken
available.
Out. Whereas me being a swinging bachelor, there's something of a strikeout rate. So you're more likely, even if you're a very attractive, delightful, charming man like myself, who should be hopping from hot bunk to hot bunk on a daily basis. Nonetheless, you probably aren't going to have sex as regularly as if you're in a relationship. We have had a decline in relationships, which I think is fascinating. What do you think that's attributed to? Do you think it's mostly online dating? Do you think it's mostly the social media environment we have?
See, actually, that was the kind of statistic I found the least surprising. I think the decline in dating is, at least living in a city like D.C., you lived in New York.
Yeah, and I lived in D.C. for a couple of years, too.
Yeah, that's true. I forget that. But kind of being in these environments where career and ambition is prized above all else, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. But certainly when I talked to my parents or my grandparents, that was not as much of a thing when they were growing up. It was not so much about, you know, what can you accomplish, but it was more about, you know, making, having a decent family life. And I think that changed a little bit before the millennial generation. But certainly when I talked to someone like my grandmother, I mean, she was married at 20 and had my mom by 21. So I think that really kind of prizing having everything else taken care of before you can think about marriage, family, whatever, is certainly, to me, the biggest contributor.
Yeah, well, and definitely in cities like that. I mean, like New York City, nobody's hanging out in New York City. New York City's
well, that's the big paradox of New York City, right? It's like there are so many people, but everyone is so lonely, it doesn't talk to anyone else.
Yeah, it's well, and that goes back to what you were talking about earlier. I think you've hit the nail on the head with there has been a very distinct difference in the what is appropriate protocol for interacting with someone. Where pre-online dating, pre-Twitter, pre-Facebook, first of all, there was a tremendous amount of ambiguity that we were comfortable with. So prior to Facebook, and I freshman year, sophomore year of college, I didn't have Facebook. I think I got it sophomore year of college, but it didn't become the, you know, it didn't become the phone book of human beings that it is now overnight.
Sure.
You would just regularly be encountered with situations where you'd go out with someone and not really know whether they liked you or not. In a romantic capacity, whereas I think online dating has kind of, by virtue of making that up front, you're very few people are online dating looking explicitly for friends. It's an established fact if you go on a date through an online dating platform that you are going you're interested. But as a result of
that,
I find that people are even more uncomfortable with ambiguity when they meet them in real life, because now we have to go through this kind of dance of, Are we dating? Do we like each other? Are we just friends? And I think people are a lot more bothered by that. And I think people are far more less apt to engage with strangers. And I thought maybe that was a New York thing, but now I'm beginning to think it's a 21st century thing. Now that I'm in Texas.
I think it's definitely a 21st century thing. Absolutely. And I also think that, you know, in this cultural moment with Me Too, which I tend to think was a very good thing overall, I do think, though, that some people in Generation Z, millennials, whatever it might be, a lot of men might feel like if they make an advance that maybe it would be construed as inappropriate, especially in different settings. Like in a, you know, I know a lot of people in my parents' generation, for instance, met at work. Now I can imagine a guy asking a woman out at work because for a moment just kind of it seems to exclude that, if that makes any sense.
I'd say it's pretty high stakes. If you're going to, you have to be very, very, very careful about the way that you're going to invite the person out. And you also need to be very careful about how that relationship plays out. Like it's, you know, there's definitely more thought that goes into it. And I don't think that everybody's become scared because of Me Too, but it has altered things. Like I read a statistic, The Economist did a survey in 2017 that said that 17% of the people in the survey believed if a man asks a woman out for a drink, that constitutes sexual harassment. I think, you know, that's about a fifth of the people responding, which means four fifths of the people would view it presumably as innocuous or perhaps irritating or something. But there is a little bit of a shift there where I don't like bothering people. And this is something that I found in New York quite a lot, where my natural disposition being a middle American from Oklahoma is it's fine to engage with people. It's fine to talk to them. I like interacting with strangers. New York, in general, you don't want to do that. You show respect by giving people space. And I found that that was double so interacting with young women. So if I went into a bar, I very much got the impression that if there were some ladies standing around, if I went up and went, hey, like I wanted to buy you a drink or something, that I would very much be bothering them. And then from their perspective, I think what ends up happening is guys like me basically remove ourselves from the equation. And so the guys that really don't care whether they're bothering them or not are the only ones that actually come up. And so they're now getting, the confident kind of jerk alpha guys, while the Norman Rockwell protocol oriented people like myself are like, well, I guess I'll go online dating.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was out with a friend who's visiting me in D.C., I guess it was last weekend. And she made the comment that, and we went to this bar, there were just so many people. And she was like, why is no one talking to anyone but the people they came with? You know, you kind of go into a bar and there are little circles of people everywhere. And, you know, you just, I guess you come with your wing people, but never actually branch out, which seems like it kind of would defeat the purpose. But I do think that people have just kind of like lost the art of, you know, taking a deep breath and going for it. You know what I mean?
Well, see, that surprises me a little bit because you're in D.C. And I found that in D.C. I was never for want of meeting people randomly. Because D.C., if for people listening at home, if you haven't spent a lot of time in D.C., Washington, D.C., imagine a lot of marble floating on a sea of bourbon. There is a ton of alcohol. Literally every congressional office has a bottle of bourbon in it, without exaggeration. You're thinking, not my congressman. He's Mormon. He lives in Utah. There's someone in his office that has a bottle of bourbon in there. Everybody's drinking all the time. And there's a ton of events that have free food and booze all the time. There, you know, when I worked on the Hill, you'd go hang out after work. We'd go to like the Minnesota Boat Association, whatever, would have a thing on, and we'd go hang out there. And it was very easy because you're at an event full of people in their 20s. No one really knows each other that well because D.C. is a city of transplants. And you're three or four drinks in. I did not find it difficult to just meet random people without resorting to online dating. But it sounds like that the heyday was when I was there, and that has been on the decline since I left.
Well, I was. That could be it. That could be one thing. I would also say when you were in D.C., was online dating as big of a factor?
I think when I came in, because I would have come into D.C. When I left D.C. was about the time that online dating became normal, I think. Because I remember one of my penultimate conversations there was I went out drinking with a couple of friends, and they had a friend that had been online dating, and that was a thing. And that would have been like 2010, where that was a topic of conversation for 45 minutes. So I probably
Got
came
it.
In before
and
the
people were just amazed by it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I would say I've never wanted to meet random friends. I have met so many random friends in D.C. For the reasons you just said, you know, lots of bourbon and networking and things like that. But I do think when you go specifically to like a bar on a Saturday night, people do kind of sile themselves off with mm-hmm. people they came with. And people often make the joke that, you know, it gets to be like 2:45, it's last call. And then everyone's looking around being like, you want to go home tonight? You want to go home tonight? No one that they've actually spoken to yet, but if they can like proposition someone with like, you know, the 15-minute final countdown, then, you know, maybe they'll get lucky.
That sounds great, but I can't even do that anymore. I'm 35. I'm not right? staying out past midnight at a dingy bar where I don't know anyone. I'm so
out with you past midnight, Andrew.
Thanks.
Marie's Crisis.
Next,
don't forget about
we
it.
Have well, yeah. Marie's Crisis. I'll close down that place. Marie's, for those that aren't familiar with this, I've mentioned it on the podcast a couple times. Marie's Crisis is my favorite bar in New York. I've actually had my last three or four birthdays there. It's a bar where everyone sings Broadway musicals, and it's fun, and it's like I like that. But like I had a roommate that in New York he'd go out to a bar like maybe four nights a week, and it was just he was going to go out there for 3 to 4 hours, and maybe he'd pick up a girl, maybe not. And I listened to that, was like, I have far better things to do with my time than just sit at a bar. And then now being 35, I'm just unless something really fun's happening, I'm not going to wait till 2:45 in the morning to try and pick somebody up. That sounds terrible. Like I'm at 12:30 at the maximum. I'm going to be like, I got work tomorrow. Netflix exists. I'm going to go home and do that. And like, good luck, ladies. I'm done. I'm out of here. Which is a side note, I do think is a factor in this. In doing research for this, one of the things that kind of began to tickle the back of my mind with the issue of declining sex is, I think if we can concede that at some point in history, sex was used as a tool to alleviate boredom, that particular impulse is pretty much gone now. Because
oh, absolutely. Especially when you think about young people having sex, which, as you said, like a lot of people are saying that's a good statistic to have that, you know, beyond the decline. But when you think about, I don't know what it was like when you were in high school, you finished a little bit before me, but I feel like we were just always going. There was the choir, there were musicals, people were in sports. You know, I feel like, you know, there are so many AP classes you're forced to step on. I don't know when I would have had sex in high school. I don't know what time I would have
had. That's definitely why I didn't have sex in high school. It was purely my overactive schedule. And the fact that I was devoutly religious and squeaky clean throughout high school. But yeah, I was very much so. I was a baritone in the church choir and an Eagle Scout.
I did not know that.
Oh, yeah, because you know me as the fun libertine character in New York passing out whiskey.
Marie's Crisis, where everyone is singing Broadway musicals.
Yeah, you know show tunes, Heaton.
That's a special Heaton.
Yeah, high school Heaton was a fun guy, but a much more tampered down guy. Like our Friday nights when I was in high school for at least a year, my friends and I would play Dungeons and Dragons because we were that awesome. And then we would get this giant battery powered spotlight and we would drive to the lake and shine it at parked cars. Those people presumably were having sex. And then they would try and kill us. They'd try and murder us. They'd chase us down, you know, for 20, 30 minutes, and then we'd get away. That was basically our Friday night. So that was the level of risque that we were doing. But I see your point, though, because I do think that the period of unstructured time has plummeted for high school students. I also feel kind of bad for college students. When I was in college, I got the impression that there'd been a shift where when my parents were in college, I think they were just expected to have good grades. I don't think they were expected, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think they were expected to do student council and also be a part of a fraternity and do five different things, but do volunteering on the side. There's an idea of kind of an overwhelming amount of activities that students are anticipated or are expected to do in college and in preparation for college and high school. And I could see that crowding out some things.
But to the and I think, like, I don't mean to take this conversation too far away from it, but I do think it is somewhat relative in the sense that I was talking with a friend a couple of weeks ago about how, you know, before you were only expected to have a high school degree, and if you went to college, good for you. Whereas now I feel like you need a graduate school degree or some sort of, you know, upper level education for it to really be meaningful because everyone goes to college. And I think that that's kind of indicative when you see high schoolers just piling on everything they can. It's because they're trying to stand out in this environment where now everyone is just such an, I don't want to say an overachiever, but essentially so. You know what I mean? It's the expectation now.
And to bring that back to sex, a couple of minor factors that could be going on is that you were probably, well, I don't want to say probably because I could see being stressed leading to sex, but I could also see it leading to a declining sex drive. If you're having less sleep, you're probably going to have a less active sleep, a sex drive. And we are chronically unslept in the United States. So I could see that happening. But on top of that, to get back to the boredom issue, I kind of think Netflix alone would alleviate boredom sex from that. Would just, that's gone now because you're never going to be for want of something interesting to do.
Very true.
I could see that happening. And then also, we should, I don't want to get too nitty gritty or graphic on this, but probably the rise of porn has had some effect on sexuality in the United States. That's, I imagine, something of an understatement. But the readily available supply of instantaneous pornography, I would imagine, would take away some of that urge to sate yourself sexually. Whereas, like, say if you were in the 70s, your access to pornography was specifically from a dark, dingy store, or you'd find it under a bench in a parking lot or a park. And so, like, they just, you know, wasn't there. So you might as well, you know, go out and go on dates and things. Whereas now that seems to be a factor. I've read a lot of studies that for a lot of young men, they'll kind of go down a porn hole and won't really emerge from it that frequently. There's a lot of couple therapy that involves that.
That makes sense to me. I think that would, like, the smallest factor, in my opinion. I feel like mostly that would be kind of indicative of, you know, the other things we've been talking about, and then people therefore resort to something like porn. I have a hard time believing that someone who didn't have social media or any of those things we've already talked about, you know, too busy schedule, didn't have online dating, but still had porn. I still think seek out sex, but I think it's kind of a, you know, that might be like the cherry on top, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I could see it being a variety of factors there that would probably happen. Let's see. So I want to go back to you. How about online dating just in general? Do you think it's soul crushing or do you think it's helpful?
I guess I kind of land somewhere in between. I wouldn't say it's soul crushing. I would say that my biggest beef with online dating isn't necessarily not getting matches. I feel like I match with people, but I feel like everyone's just very flaky.
Yeah.
Which is my biggest pet peeve, just in any part of life, not just for lovers, but also friends. If you make a commitment, I need you to stick to it. This new ghosting trend, which, you know, I know is not really even a dating buzzword anymore. It's just like,
yeah, there's new words that I don't even know. There's like zombieing and a bunch of other things.
But, yeah, exactly.
But the ghosting used to be a thing.
Like, yeah. And now everyone just knows what it is because everyone does it. I find that to be so aggravating. You know, even if I understand that when you meet someone online, you don't owe them anything, but I do think that having the common decency to, you know, follow through with your commitments is important. And I think that, you know, with all this online virtual interaction, that kind of seems to fall by the wayside. It's easy to just kind of retreat behind your phone. And I'm definitely one of those people, you know, there are all these anecdotes of, you know, throwing your phone up and giving up on online dating forever, and then you're back on it 3 months later. That's totally my pattern.
Okay.
After someone pisses me off, I'll be like, no, I'm never doing this again. And of course, I find myself picking back up where I left off, mostly because, as we've talked about, there aren't really many other options.
I'm about to be in that binge purge pattern that you just mentioned. I think online dating,
because
I kind of found a shift for me when I was in my late 20s and in my early 30s. It was, online dating was fine. It could be a little bit, even then I was sort of aware that, I'm not going to say it was bad, but it was inefficient in that you might match with, let's say, 10 people. You'll spend 40 minutes swiping or whatever the vehicle is, And of that, let's say 2% swipe back. And then of that 2%, you maybe are able to engage in a conversation with half of them. And then of that, half of that leads to an actual date. So I was aware even then that it would, but you could do it and you're like, okay, I'm single again. I'm going to do some online dating. And then I'd get a new girlfriend, maybe after a month. It kind of something altered around 33, and I'm not sure whether that, like, suddenly I was in a new, different age bracket. I do think Donald Trump played a role in it. I'm not going to blame the complete desert of sexuality that was 2017 on Donald Trump entirely, but I do think he played a role in it, in that when I started out in New York, I was a writer for Fox Business, and I was mostly plugged into the comedy community, so I was either meeting people through online dating or I was meeting them through improv, and online dating probably the majority of it. And the Fox thing really wasn't a deal breaker pre-Trump, because it was sort of, I work for Fox Business, I write for a show called The Independence, it's not partisan, I love gay people. And they'd go, oh, okay. Like, as long as I sort of established that there wasn't any, kind of homophobic or anti-immigrant tendency, then there really wasn't an issue. Once Trump came in, I feel like that it almost became like a religious thing, in the way that, like, in the 50s, you could be Protestant, you couldn't marry a Catholic because your family would just absolutely not. We're all German descended Protestants or whatever. I feel like that kind of deep tribal division has shifted entirely to politics, because I found that post Trump, it was much more problematic for me not to be a progressive Democrat than it had been even
Absolutely.
6 months before. What's it like for you in D.C.? Because you're an independent or you're a libertarian. I'm not really sure where you are, but I think you're a Republican or a Democrat, is my guess.
I am not, correct.
Okay.
So I work for Reason Magazine at the moment, which is a libertarian publication. I was very much on the small L side of that.
Yeah.
So I'm, they say big L libertarians are the ones who are, a bit gray and closer to anarchism. Mm-hmm. But I would say, I'm certainly, like you said, not right-leaning or left-leaning universally. I also happen to be gay, mm-hmm. which in D.C., a place that is already heavily liberal, I think they said in the 2016 election it was something like 93% voted for Hillary Clinton, which, as you know, is not a shock.
I thought for a moment you were going to say it was 93% gay, which was going to make me feel way better about my dating life while I was there. Because it would have this explains so much. I'm not surprised that D.C. went overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. That does not shock me in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I've heard the 93% thrown around, whether that's 93% who self-identify as liberal or who voted for Clinton. I'm not exactly sure, but very heavily liberal place. And I do find that some people, when they find out I am not super left-leaning, are just shocked and appalled based on kind of the identity politics at the moment, which says a gay person has to be as liberal as it comes. I actually went on a date, it's probably 3 or 4 weeks ago now, and he had found me on Facebook, which, kudos to him for his.
That's old school. He's a traditionalist.
Right? Exactly.
Looking up your profile that you probably put in 2007 and haven't updated it since then. You're really into Van Morrison.
The only thing I put on my Facebook these days are links to my articles, and they happen to be public. Everything else is private. So he had read like 6 of them and had come prepared to fight. And
oh,
that
really?
Was arguing about.
Sounds terrible.
I'd written. Oh, I agree. The entire day. And I had written more cleaning pieces. I used to be a contributor at HuffPost when that was still a thing.
You're an independently minded, fairly nuanced person that doesn't fit neatly into a box, which is commendable.
Sure. Which is not what he took from that. He took my Reason Magazine articles, which have largely been on kind of critiquing the minimum wage, especially as it relates to food policy, the restaurant industry, something I'm very interested in. Also something I'd written for Washington Examiner, a publication. And like I said, he had not only read it, he was referencing statistics I had used and was just like ready to fight on this. And I said like 2 or 3, I was like, I'm not quite sure why you came. Like, why you didn't just cancel on me?
Yeah, are we going to have like an angry makeout session? Is that what we're gearing up for? That's where I would be like, I'm game for this if you are, but I'm not really sure where you're going to go with this.
The romance was not, alive on that Saturday afternoon.
I don't think the politics is helping at all. I think that it's the idea of trying to put people in sort of fire ringed boxes and treat them like super religions is not going to be. I would have to think that would cut down on available options amongst many other things. Like I said, the end goal for the United States should be to be having 20% less sex than I have. If guys like you, by that metric, I should be getting laid more. Because that's going to benefit everybody else. So, let's be a little bit less litigious and, you know, angry with the politics.
Right. I mean, in that vein, though, when people ask where I work, I don't want to say I get nervous to say it's a libertarian congregation, but people think libertarian is a dirty word, which I'm sure you have. You were just saying, you know, you have experienced that as well.
I've encountered it, yeah.
To me, has many left-leaning connotations. They're all down with the gays, you know, women's rights.
Libertarians tend to be very, very libertine, and like libertarians tend to be like, you know, okay, like you're gay, do you drop acid? Like that tends to be a little bit to the left, actually, or to the a little bit more kind of open to things than even like a mainstream Democrat. So on a social level, you're probably, you know, lockstep, if not a bit further.
Yeah, 100%. I've always thought of it as like, you know, you do you, and they'll do me.
Are you so when you get pushback, do you find that it's because you're not a part of the right tribe, or is it like that you're a traitor because you're gay but you're not liberal, or what's the kind of?
I would definitely say it's a mix of both, but I think the latter is all the more powerful. You know, this guy I went on a date with spent a big chunk of the conversation talking about why, you know, I was going against my own self-interest, and that's the kind of thing where I still have a hard time believing that that's a thing in 2019, that we really can't think a little more critically than that, or at least do our research. You obviously know this. Libertarians were for gay marriage before Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama were for gay marriage.
By quite some time, by like maybe 20 years or so leading the pack in that matter.
Absolutely. So
ditto pot. Like remember Joe Biden was like, you know, wanting to throw people in jail for 20 years in the 90s for, you know, dealing marijuana, whereas libertarians were like looking to, you know, re-legalize marijuana, but also like maybe mushrooms and cocaine and some other things too. Like it tended to be, you know, three steps ahead of that regard.
Sure. And it's like crackdown on sex work. I mean, and that's something that both sides are usually, you know, let's arrest prostitutes. I mean, I would say I'm more progressive than a mainstream Democrat, like you're saying, but I mean, I don't really get any street cred because I also am supposed to be super fiscally liberal, or I'm portraying my identity, something like that.
That's right. You're a terrible gay if you're not for minimum wage, because the two are so completely linked together. Can you not see the obvious blazing connection between a minimum wage of $15 an hour and wanting to sleep with men? These are absolutely intimately connected.
I was sitting in like a political roundtable discussion with friends, and I kind of excused myself, but good thing these were just friends, not lovers, so they like me regardless. But they were talking about Amazon and gay disenfranchisement, and I was just sitting there like, I have no idea how these two are related. I'm trying to like carry the two. Like I don't understand how you're coming to this conclusion. I just got up and went to the kitchen and stood in there by myself.
Yeah, I think there's a real tendency in politics right now to kind of weaponize everything. And also to try and raise the stakes on everything, because it's no longer enough to just go, well, I disagree with you on that matter. It needs to be, I disagree with you, and here's why. It's important because you're doing this horrific thing when you have that opinion. And so everything kind of gets taken to a factor of 10, it alleviates the actual discourse that we're capable of having.
Absolutely. I mean, in that vein, though, you know, we talk about how tribal it's become. I have also I've gone on dates with left-leaning people and right-leaning people as well. I went on a date with a Trump aide, actually. Uh-huh. So it was about a year and a half ago now. He told me he knew what covfefe meant.
Wait, he knew what meant?
Covfefe? Do you remember the
famous covfefe? Oh, yeah, covfefe, yeah. C-O-V-F-E-F-E. What was it?
Yeah, and he told me he knew what that meant. And so I said, okay, have a nice life.
so you went out but weren't real inclined to keep going out with the Trumper?
I mean, it had nothing to do with his political views, more so kind of like I felt like it was very tribal, but he was sitting there trying to defend this like 3 a.m. tweet where Trump had obviously tried to write media coverage and ended up media covfefe, but
yeah.
He had needed to double down and tell me that he knew
I see. So
the word covfefe was.
It was more the sort of unblinking, unwavering support of a clear misstep that was disturbing. Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, what I'm trying to say is that I think the critical thinking is missing from not just the left, but the right as well. I think that we really have just kind of, you know, doubled down on our politics, kind of defining who we are.
And, yeah.
I feel like it is somewhat new. I mean, I haven't been dating for so long. I guess I started dating when I was, you know, 18, 19, so about 10 years. And I don't think it was always like this. I mean, I certainly don't feel like at least there were litmus tests like for that Trump aide, certainly, like he had said something like, I've always loved Trump. I will always love Trump. You know, you can't work for the Trump White House if you were ever part of the Never Trump movement, whatever. And he certainly had a litmus test of his own, you know, like I needed to be right leaning. And I find it all very exhausting.
I think it's been there before, but it's coming to, it's greatly exaggerated now. And I think the other factor that's going on is that I had a guest on maybe 2 months ago, Morris Fiorina, and his thesis is that we're not getting more polarized, rather we're getting better sorted. So, you know, 20 years ago, you could be a conservative Democrat or you could be a moderate or progressive Republican. So if you were a part of a party, it didn't necessarily denote everything about what you thought, nor did it denote the totality of your values. Whereas today, because the Republican Party is more homogenous than it used to be, and the Democratic Party is more homogenous than it used to be, people make, I think, a lot more presumptions of what that infers about you by virtue of being a part of it, or part of being out of the out-group, as I find. Because a lot of the time, for folks like you and me that aren't a part of the two-party system, I find the people that are really deep into it have a difficult time thinking outside of that binary. So if you're not on my team, you were by definition on the other team. And I'm like, but they don't want me either. And that doesn't matter. Hold on. So we're going to finish up in a moment. I want to go back to one thing you mentioned earlier that kind of caught my attention. And I think you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, but you mentioned a sort of a glut of choices and that you thought that could be in part explaining why we're coupling up less. So walk me through that.
Well, I feel like when you just have so many choices at your fingertips, which is the epitome of not only living in the big city, like I think this was always a thing, but also now that we have online dating where we can just swipe endlessly. You know, even as a gay person, you'd think that you'd get to the point of like, there are no more people in the surrounding area. There must be a lot of gay people in DC because I've never run out. And I just feel like when you constantly have so many people to pick from, you kind of convince yourself that there's always something better.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's necessarily like a self-preservation thing or just human nature.
There's probably some evolutionary component to that, but I think you're right. If you never leave the shop, it's probably difficult to really embrace monogamy if you're always kind of looking over your shoulder. I could see that being a thing. A lot of my growing up in Oklahoma, the friends that I have that are from small towns that stayed there, from what I can tell, kind of around the end of college, maybe 23, 24, went, okay, there are about, 20 women that live in my town. I really like her. Would get married, and then they're fine. They're very happy right now. And I think it's probably a part because they didn't have to really, it was just sort of, they're like, I like living in this county. I'm going to live here. This person lives here. And I like them. They weren't going on like an epic, movie-esque quest to find their ultimate soulmate. They were, kind of like, okay, let's make this work with what we got. And it seems to be working for them better than a lot of my friends in the big cities.
Yeah, exactly. And I think like a smaller part of it is also this kind of emphasis on having a fairy tale love story almost. Not that I would consider myself somewhat of a romantic, but when I talked to my grandparents, as I mentioned earlier, my grandmother would never say that she was looking for like, I could have danced all night, to reference some of these crisis show tunes here.
You're looking for somebody that could like milk a cow and then potentially kill it.
Exactly.
A much more pragmatic perspective on it.
Sweeping me off my feet. I have to feel like Cinderella. I've talked to so many of my friends who say they just haven't had that fairy tale love story yet. It's kind of like, I'd like to think that we could all get that, but I think that we're emphasizing those types of butterfly feelings maybe a little too much sometimes over things that are practical, and which is compounded by the fact that when you think you have so many to choose from, you're just going to keep searching until you find what's perfect. You know what I mean? There might never be someone that's perfect, but there might be someone that's really good.
I think that is stupendous advice. I will intuit that, and I imagine a couple of the listeners have as well. Billy, thank you for joining me. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. It's fun.
Okay. If you haven't been paying attention to the controversy in Virginia, allow me to fill you in as quickly as I can. Last week, someone unearthed Governor Northam's yearbook from med school, where he is apparently wearing blackface and standing next to a man in a KKK outfit. Northam apologized, then he said it wasn't actually him later. Then he admitted to doing blackface in a completely separate event as part of a Michael Jackson costume. But he refuses to moonwalk no matter how often I tweeted him. Then Lieutenant Governor Fairfax, who would become governor if Northam stepped down, was accused of sexually assaulting a woman. And a second woman has now come forward claiming that he acted inappropriately with her as well. The third person in line is the Attorney General, who has also admitted to appearing in blackface as a rapper for a costume party. Now, for complicated constitutional reasons, I am eighth in line to become governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I don't want to be yet another domino in whatever weird political game this is. So I'm going to get ahead of the curve and admit my own controversies up front in hopes that I can frame it on my own terms and move on. Okay. Whew. All right. I dressed up in blackface one time, which I regret. I did it just once, from 1985 to 1987. In retrospect, the 2 years I continuously appeared in uninterrupted blackface were hurtful and, at the very least, probably very confusing to a number of people. I did appear in the film Coming to America in a bit part alongside Eddie Murphy, and while that was thrilling, I regret the false pretenses under which I accepted that acting assignment. I deeply and unequivocally regret the emotional pain I may have inflicted. For that reason, I am officially abdicating my claims to the throne of Virginia. Believe me when I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility and to discharge my duties as king as I would wish to do without the help and support of the woman I love. I have made this the most serious decision of my life, only upon the single thought of what would, in the best, be good for all. The ministers of the crown, and in particular Mr. Baldwin, the prime minister, have always treated me with full consideration. There's never been any constitutional difference between me and them, or between me and Parliament. I now quit altogether public affairs, and I lay down my burden. It may be some time before I return to my native land, but I shall always follow the fortunes of Virginia and the Commonwealth with profound interest, and if at any time in the future I can be of service to His Majesty in private station, I shall not fail. I wish him and you, his people, happiness and prosperity with all my heart. All right, some listener feedback, specifically from iTunes. If you have not rated and reviewed the show, please do. That honestly really helps us out. So this is someone from iTunes, and I appreciate it. David Palmer, MBA, writes, I heard a rodeo clown introduce Andrew on a small national radio program out of Texas. I was quite impressed. Andrew is a witty guy who creates a delightful mix of politics and popular culture in a great podcast. Believe it or not, he is funny too. Give Andrew a try. Also, Snuffy's Diner is a great sponsor. If I lived closer, I would try to eat all my meals there. Well, that is a sterling recommendation for both me and Snuffy's. Thank you, David. I greatly appreciate it. And thank you for those of you that have already reviewed me. And to those who haven't, do it. Also, remember, you can always tweet me at Mighty Heaton or Facebook me at facebook.com/MightyHeaton or even email me by subscribing to my newsletter at MightyHeaton.com and just replying when I send it out on Fridays. I do try to get to all of that. I'd also like to encourage you to subscribe to Blaze TV and download the Blaze TV app. If you do, you can watch me instead of just listening to me. Use the promo code Heaton to get $10 off your annual Blaze TV subscription. I look like a youthful Pablo de Valladolid. A listener wrote that. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Susan emailed that to me. I believe Pablo de Valladolid was a jester in the court of Philip IV of Spain. If so, I will take it. Thank you. So download Blaze TV app on iTunes or Google Play. Get subscribed to the Blaze and fall in love with me more than you already are. You can watch portions of the show on Facebook Watch by going to facebook.com/HeatonTV. Finally, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. That helps other people discover this here political orphanage. Thank you and good day.